wish I was a mole in the ground.
First Nations and our people that been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline.
Tots, may we oikoloma. Good morning, my people. That was a mashup of the Old Mole song with Taboo singing Stand Up for Standing Rock. This is KBOO 90.7, listener-supported community radio. Nimi Pumol here, Julian Ankeny, coming to you from Portland, Oregon, and headed back soon to Lapway, Idaho, on the Nez Perce Reservation. I'll be your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour, a show that brings you news and views from a socialist, feminist, decolonizing perspective. This morning, we're once again bringing you audio excerpts from the April 21st and 22nd virtual Washington State University Conference on Native Sovereignty, Decolonization, Divestment, Reparations, and Environmental Justice, Constructing Coalitions at the Intersections, sponsored by Washington State University Vancouver, Native Programs, and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice, and co-sponsored by Portland State University's Indigenous Nations Studies Program. And in between segments, we'll be playing music from an all-Native lineup of artists. Ketsiao Yao, thank you. Today's show features the following segments: Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, Fossil Fuels, Man Camps, and a Case for Divestment, Reinvestment, and Reparations; The Sexual Exploitation, Torture, and Disappearance of Native Americans Has Deep Historical Roots, beginning in 1492. Today, we have a panel discussion featuring WSU MA student Shuvro Das, Salilo Wayam activist Lana Jack, Christian Edmark with Divest Washington, and Stevie Fawcett, a WSU undergraduate and organizer, Fossil Free WSU. Speaking to the gap, health disparities, and mortality in Indian country, historical and ongoing patterns of colonial violence, racism, and the exploitation of Indigenous lands and peoples translate into a host of health disparities, including higher rates of infant and maternal mortality. Featuring Danica Brown, MSW, PhD, Choctaw of the Watonalak, Oshi White Crane Clan, Behavioral Health Program Director, Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, Melanie Henshaw, Muscogee Creek, Indigenous Affairs Reporter for Street Roots, and Stephen Fawcett, WSU student in microbiology, Centering Culture in Climate Resilience, featuring Michelle Pinkham, Two-Spirit Mimipu, Development and Community Engagement Manager, NARA Northwest, and Christy DeRosa, Social Work, PhD student and Research Assistant, Trauma Informed Oregon, and moderated by Lakota Cheyenne Mole. We start the first panel on Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, Fossil Fuels, Man Camps, and a Case for Divestment, Reinvestment, and Reparations, with a voice of Shuvro Das.
So the risks of oil development on Native reservations are distinct from development in other areas of the U.S., as a federal Indian law requires a jurisdictional analysis which focuses on the identity of the perpetrator and the land status of the location where the crime occurred to determine which governmental body is responsible for arrest, detention, and prosecution. So according to the U.S. Department of Justice, Indigenous women in this country, particularly in the U.S., have face murder rates that are more than 10 times higher than the national average. Homicide is the third highest cause of death in Indigenous women and girls who are in the age bracket of 10 to 24, and the fifth for women that are between the age bracket of 25 to 34. Also in Canada, Indigenous women are less than 5% of the female population, but in 2015, they comprised 25% of all murdered women in this nation. 96% of these women experienced violence from a non-Indigenous perpetrator. So I think these numbers are staggering. We all know about the non-native man camps. It's usually created and by people in native lands, but who are not native. This leaves tribal members vulnerable to major crimes that cannot be prosecuted by their own tribe. And that has been coupled with jurisdictional, cultural, and legal limitations that non-native perpetrators have the potential to commit heinous crimes with limited repercussion. So since the oil boom, native communities have reported increased rates of human trafficking, sex trafficking, and missing and murdered Indigenous women in their own communities. Workers who come to a region for well-paid oil and gas jobs often set up man camps, which is usually created and inhabited by non-native, and it's placed in largely rural areas. And areas in these camps strain infrastructures which in communities that already have inadequate resources to support population booms. In 2015, violent crime reports increased in the Bakken oil-producing region of Montana and North Dakota due to the socioeconomic changes that have been brought to the area by the big oil boom. According to one report, sexual assaults on women on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota increased by 75%. And conversely, there was no corresponding rise in violent crimes in the countries outside of the Bakken oil region. Keystone XL pipeline, if completed, the pipeline would transport oil sands from Canada to the Gulf Coast. In South Dakota and Montana, towns around reservation communities bordering the pipeline route would play temporary host to approximately 1,000 pipeline construction workers as they complete the project. Due to the jurisdictional and Supreme Court precedent, policing these camps would shift to county sheriffs and the FBI, and those agencies that are often more concerned with policing protests surrounding the pipeline, due to obviously the political interest.
Katsiao Yao Shuro, thank you so much. Our next panelist, Lena Jack.
Our people have been suffering under this brutal sex trafficking that has gone on since 1492. Sacagawea, Sacagawea did not go along with John Smith. She was a child, a child. She became, on record, the first and missing murder to become famous by their standard. For generations now, our women have been the leadership of our people. My mom used to say, the heart of the nation, the backbone of our communities, a matriarch society, a matrilineal people. The hearts of our women have been thrown to the ground, left to bleed out as they take our children from us for generations. Nothing's changed for 500 years in America. Pocahontas was not the Disney tale they want to tell about her either, and how media plays in all of this. You can't know this grief unless you've lived it. And we've lived it for generations and generations. And missing and murdered for us has been normalized because nobody has done nothing, because Indian country is Indian country. On this Columbia River, we have just as many men gone missing as women. Nobody on this river talks about it. We're all isolated in our own little spots and nobody wants to talk about it. But I hear about it individually as I go into our villages and listen to our people. We have more missing men than women right now on this Columbia River. The connection is that we are the land. What they do to the land, they do to us. There's no severing us from the land. Assimilate us, culturate us, do everything to get rid of our way of being and knowing our sacredness as the matrilineal people. When I went out to Standing Rock, there was so many people out there, so many nations and tribes, Indigenous people from across the world, and their story is the same. I came from a beaver dam this morning, and my beavers reminded me this morning that their fate is our fate. Our food systems are polluted. Our waterways are polluted. This is our home, the water. The symbiotic interconnectedness of our humanness to everything around us is so misunderstood, so devalued, paganized, heathens we are for continuing to love our Mother Earth. No water, no life. No beavers, no life. No salmon, no life. We're there now. We're at that place our people talked about. Our children are going missing. 5, 6, 7 children off the Lakota Nation's reserves all around. There's 7 council fires. Their children a week. That's 5 or 6 children a week. People left to themselves getting away with this kind of stuff are empowered to continue to do so. And they're getting away with it. I can't even imagine what my mothers have seen. I know what I've seen. I know what I've been through as a woman.
Katsiao, Yao, Lana, thank you so much for your emotions and your story. It is a monumental, really, the things that we as Indigenous people go through. And I must remind everyone that this is a problem that not only cuts across ages and genders. Missing and Murdered Indigenous People and Families is an inclusive initiative to bring awareness to the fact that while most of the attention and research is on the violence against Indigenous women and girls, our men and boys and two-spirit relatives are vulnerable as well, right? Indigenous men, as well as two-spirit people and their disappearances, murders, need to be addressed as well. We need to address the patterns of violence, the patterns of victimization against men and boys, along with women and girls, and make sure that they are also placed in the context of gendered and settler colonial violence as well. Every person we search for, every person we march for, every person that we grieve for is another person that law enforcement has disregarded, devalued, dehumanized, and cases were also never brought to light. Human beings, Ngatitlwit, all people are sacred beings. We bring attention to every border town and city ignored, abused, abducted, and trafficked Indigenous people has been grossly ignored. These are the stories that the news media refuses to tell, the cases that legal systems do not prosecute. The facts are that man camps and oil and land acknowledgments are all interconnected to missing and murdered Indigenous people. The epidemic of missing Native people has been an almost invisible crisis for far too long, until very, very recently. A study done by the Urban Indian Health Institute found that 5,712 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people and girls were reported since 2015, and those are only the documented cases. There are stories, so many stories, personal stories of the undocumented or unreported cases, that 96% of violence against Indigenous people are from non-natives, and people need to be held accountable in the offices of power, literally for the survivance of our communities. I would like to hand it over to our next two panelists that are here with us today, sharing their wisdom and words. Kristen Edmark, again, she's a volunteer co-leader with Divest Washington, and Stephen Fawcett, a member of Fossil Free WSU Environmental Sustainability Alliance. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be part of this panel. Many of us are working to stop fossil fuel projects and expansion. I worked 4 years to help stop the Kalama methanol refinery, which would have increased the amount of methane coming into Washington state by 50%, converted it to methanol, and exported the methanol to China. It became obvious that the refinery was looking for other people's money to fund the refinery construction. A private equity company, Stone Peak, agreed to fund the $2 billion construction. Washington state invests in the state pensions in Stone Peak. The story is pretty much the same for new fossil fuel expansion. When we follow the money to its source, we often find the state of Washington pensions. Zenith Energy Portland was founded and is owned by the private equity company Warburg Pincus. Zenith Energy exports oil transported on long trains near urban areas and through the Columbia Gorge to Portland, where it is mostly exported to China. In June 2021, Washington had over $2.5 billion invested in Warburg Pincus. The Coastal GasLink pipeline would transport between 2 and 5 billion cubic feet of LNG, methane, per day. It's owned 65% by KKR and AMCO and 35% by TC Energy. Washington had over $3 billion invested in KKR as of June 30th, 2021. And last April, Washington invested an additional $750 million in KKR North America Fund 13. The strong opposition by the Wet'suwet'en, their supporters, and people worried about the environment has cost the pipeline millions in delays and cost overruns. We hear a lot about the opposition led by the Wet'suwet'en, but the pipeline actually crosses the lands of 20 Indigenous nations. Tacoma LNG is a methane export terminal. Construction began on the Puyallup lands before the terminal was approved and without meaningful consultation. The terminal is strongly contested. TC Energy, which also owns Keystone Pipeline, many other pipelines, including part of the Coastal GasLink pipeline, wants to add pump stations to increase the pressure and capacity of the 25-year-old GTN pipeline through parts of Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and California. The present supply is adequate, and we're not expecting to need more natural gas. These are only a few examples. Funding of fossil fuel productions and new fossil fuel infrastructure projects harms local communities and slows the transition to clean energy. Washington has billions invested in fossil fuels and fossil fuel funders. 4.7% of Washington state investments, or about $8 billion, are directly in fossil fuel companies support and fossil fuel dependent utilities. 14%, or $24 billion, in funders of fossil fuel projects. Divest Washington is part of the National Climate Safe Pension Network created and staffed by Stand Earth. Stand Earth contracted with Third Rail Economies to identify fossil fuel investments and amounts within each participating state pension. So we have information about Washington investments as of June 20th, 21st, and we'll soon have 2022. We know how much is in production and the coal exit list and the actual investments. We were given a tool that's allowing us to search the amounts invested in specific companies. So we know companies like KKR and TC Energy. Divest Washington is a coalition of individuals and groups. We agree that Washington should make no new fossil fuel investments, should identify and track investments and phase them out quickly using social justice framework that accounts for impacts on frontline communities across the state, including rural communities and communities of color. But we need more voices. We need them to know that a lot of people care.
Thank you for that presentation. That was really, really awesome. We want WSU, which is currently investing in fossil fuel companies, to pull their funds out of fossil fuel companies. And more specifically, we want to look at the top 200 fossil fuel companies. So what universities have been doing is they've been lobbying the administration to pull funds out of those companies. It's a very clear and a very effective way to de-incentivize fossil fuel companies, and it's worked. So I wanted to share a few other institutions that have committed to divestment or have already divested. You know, you can see some names here that are very familiar: Seattle University, Oregon State University, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Oxford, Stanford. I mean, these are Pac-12 schools. These are schools in Washington. Divesting from fossil fuels certainly isn't, you know, out of reach. And this is just part of the list. I think there's around 60 to 80 other universities that have already committed to divestment.
Somewhere.
Tots Maley, good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm your host, Julian Ankeny. You heard Mother by Eulalie, and before that, you heard segments from a panel on missing and murdered Indigenous people, fossil fuels, man camps, and a case for divestment, reinvestment, and reparations. All of the audio from today's show is from the April 21st and 22nd Conference on Native Sovereignty, Decolonization, Divestment, Reparations, and Environmental Justice, Constructing Coalitions at the Intersections. When we post the show, we'll also post the full audio of the panels. Next up, Speaking to the Gap, Health Disparities and Mortality in Indian Country, we begin with Danica Brown, Behavioral Health Programs Director, Northwest Portland, Erie Indian Health Board.
Halito Achichiok Shlubo Hili Li Fijik. I'm Danica, and I'm a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. And I am the Behavioral Health Programs Director at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. And the Indian Health Board, there's 12 health boards across the country that started about 50 years ago out of a series of lawsuits suing the Indian Health Service for abuse and neglect of tribal people. And the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, we serve the 43 federally recognized tribes in the Pacific Northwest, so in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. My mentor, Karina Walters, who I later on found out is also my cousin, she's a Choctaw scholar. She teaches at the University of Washington. Her and Jane Simone and Tessa Evans Campbell created the Indigenous Stress Coping Model, which really talks about why there are disproportionate amounts of health outcomes, negative health outcomes in tribal communities. And there's a ton and ton of research that shows that there's a connection between trauma and negative health outcomes. And part of it is, you know, particularly powerful is the process by which colonization has become internalized for American Indian people and serves to shape our health outcomes. Because of the genocide against Indigenous people in the Americas is one of the most massive and longest lasting campaigns in human history. And we know that historical traumatic events have contributed to these disparities related to social and behavioral factors, resulting in increased younger female-headed households, significantly higher poverty rates, lower median income, lower education, and which leads to cofactors like HIV risk, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, substance use and dependence, as well as mental health issues like post-traumatic stress and anxiety and depression. And there's just a lot of research that demonstrate the harmful impact of colonization on Indigenous people. When we think about trauma, we also want to understand that trauma, the word trauma, is really a colonial word and a colonial construct. And using trauma terminology usually implies that the individual is responsible for their response rather than the broader systemic forces caused by the abuse of state power. And alternative terms that we talk about in Indian country are centered around an Indigenous worldview, which would consider like other parallel realities or multiple realities, which recognize the value and legitimacy of these experiences. When we think about trauma, it's an ancient survival response that we develop to survive. And it's our body's innate desire to survive, which is actually a really beautiful thing. Trauma is not some burden or wound that we carry that makes us something less than. It actually is a way of our desire to survive as human beings. Later on in life, those techniques that we use to survive early childhood no longer serve us in a meaningful way and create more harm later on in life. And so I want to talk a little bit about historical trauma. Maria Brevard Yellow Horse defines historical trauma as a cumulative emotional and psychological wounding over the lifespan and across generations, emanating from massive group trauma. And Eduardo Duran, he refers to this as soul wounding. These soul wounding systems of historical loss are interconnected. The negative impact of broad social factors that have been influenced by colonization, such as racism, acculturation, poverty, are then translated into everyday physical and emotional distress experiences. And there is some evidence to show that this is epigenetically transferred. So this is a picture of my grandfather. His name was Little Joe Gomez. His real name was Watch a Standing Buffalo. And he used to tell me that the memories of our ancestors are passed down on our blood. And so this was a man who never, he didn't even have a birth certificate. He never went to school, but he understood what we now call epigenetic transfer of trauma and historical trauma. But what he's also saying is that there's an epigenetic transfer of our ancestral wisdom and knowledge that's also passed down on our blood. And so, you know, there's lots of historical issues to consider, you know, genocide, assimilation, termination policy. But one of the most important things for me is to understand that, you know, there is hope. We know that trauma reactions can impact us in negative ways, but we also know that we're strong and resilient. I want to talk a little bit about what health and wellness means from a traditional Indigenous perspective. In many of our tribal languages, there is no word for disease or illness or health. We have words for wellness or being in balance or being in continuity with the natural rhythms of the world. And so from an Indigenous perspective, you know, health and wellness is centered in a holistic model. And these include philosophies that are equally consider the spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical aspects. Renee Linklater, she wrote a really beautiful book called Decolonizing Trauma Work. And she says in there, the mind and body split has influenced so much of psychiatric thinking. And within an Indigenous perspective, we want to bring all of those things back in together and back to balance. But it's not just the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. It's also our relationship with our ancestors, past, present, and future, our relationship with the land, and then within community. But one of the things that's really been coming up, and I'll close with this idea, is that culture is medicine. And, you know, when we're thinking about how to support people to engage in culture as medicine and to, you know, encourage clients to participate in Indigenous healing practices and reaching out to their traditional medicine people, incorporating traditional Indigenous knowledge into treatment settings. In Oregon, we're the only state in the union that has acknowledged 25 tribal-based practices. And we can get funding to be able to do that. But what we know is that if trauma impacts the epigenetic transfer of trauma, culture and connection can mitigate these effects. And if we want to prevent substance misuse and other health disparities, we need to focus on stress, trauma, and poverty while providing intervention options that are grounded in traditional Indigenous knowledge.
Thank you so much, Danica. And I'd just like to invite Melanie.
He's Che, Melanie Joho Jifkados, AJ Aloha Gados. My name is Melanie. I am a Muskogee citizen, and I am the Indigenous Affairs reporter for Street Roots newspaper in Portland, Oregon. One of the recent stories that I reported on was on a change in the funding structure for the Indian Health Service, or IHS. Late last year, Congress approved a change to the funding structure for IHS for the next budgetary cycle, thanks to the tireless effort of many tribal leaders and advocacy organizations like the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. There's major discrepancies between what the U.S. government believes IHS needs for full funding and what Native advocates and providers say IHS needs in order to provide a good level of care to the roughly 2.6 million Native Americans and Alaska Natives who use IHS. We're talking tens of millions of dollars in difference between these estimates. So lack of sufficient and stable funding really contributes to issues with staff recruitment, staff retention. Most Natives live in urban areas, and there's a critical need for more funding, specifically for funding for urban Indian health clinics, which can't just pull from the general funds for IHS. It only can receive funding through specific budget line item. IHS is severely neglected, and report after report after report reiterates that neglect. Funding really only addresses part of the problems that IHS faces, though. There are other really major problems that are at play that need not only short-term policy fixes or funding adjustments, but long-term institutional changes that are needed to improve IHS. There was the 2020 report that was commissioned by the Department of the Inspector General that showed glaring deficiencies throughout IHS that ranged from mismanagement of funds to a lack of incentive to perform well, a misunderstanding of how IHS even worked, as well as some extremely concerning statistics about patient harm that folks endured while they were at IHS. Roughly 13% of the documented patients who were at IHS that were studied in this report experienced patient harm. That's drastically higher than the average, which I believe is around 7%. And that's only what's documented. There's huge problems with data collection that begs the question of, if this is what's being reported, what are the true numbers of what's actually going on? The report also found there was a tendency to not follow IHS's own guidelines regarding patient care, specifically with regards to maternal care, which is reflected in the abysmal maternal mortality rates that Native communities are facing. So, for example, if you're looking at postpartum hemorrhaging, on average, between 1 and 3% of people are suffering postpartum hemorrhage after giving birth. In IHS, this report found it was 33% of people were suffering a postpartum hemorrhage, 33%, and that's what's documented. There are efforts and a lot of push from tribal advocates, Native groups, tribes themselves, to increase funding for IHS, and as well, a lot on the tribal side to change the structure of IHS. IHS has historically terrible relationship with the communities that it's supposed to serve. So there really needs to be changes at the institutional level that align IHS's goals with the goals of Native people. People that I've spoken with really emphasize the respect for Native belief systems, family structure, as well as the incorporation of Native spirituality and respect for ceremony. Really important topic is abortion access. So prior to the reversal of Roe last year, the landscape for abortion access for Native people was complicated. Now it's even more so. Some of the existing barriers that were already going on was something called the Hyde Amendment. So the Hyde Amendment restricts federal funds from being used to provide abortions, except in very rare cases, such as in the case of rape, incest, and in like very, very extreme medical conditions. As a result, IHS rarely, if ever, pays for abortions. It's really tough to get there. Distance-wise, even a few miles can be pose like an insurmountable barrier. And as whole states and regions begin to seemingly outlaw abortion, that increases the distance. Financially, if IHS is your healthcare provider and they won't pay for your abortion, you're going to have to find a way to pay for it yourself. So we're seeing the increase in popularity in abortion funds where people are seeking out third-party assistance to pay for these services. Barriers continue to worsen as abortion access continues to lessen. And also, you think about the disturbingly high maternal mortality rates, postpartum hemorrhaging that I was just speaking about. And if more Native women who aren't ready or Native people who aren't ready or willing to give birth are forced to and aren't receiving adequate care, what does that say for the maternal mortality rate? There's a fundamental lack of respect from the U.S. government for Native people, for our life ways, for our beliefs and family structures, the way that we treat our wellness. And without an incorporation and a respect for that, without bringing Native voices to the table to lead the conversation about our wellness and about our health, it's my personal opinion that these barriers will continue and these discrepancies in welfare will continue.
Melanie, thank you so much. Stevie?
Climate change is a really big issue for multiple reasons. And one of those reasons is that they're going to increase the risk of infection from zoonotic disease. So diseases that are transmitted from animals and insects to humans, West Nile virus and hantaviruses, those are transmitted from animals to humans. As climate change continues to change weather patterns, we're actually going to see more of those. And that is going to also exacerbate current health care disparities that we see in the United States. I'll start with the West Nile virus, which is what I know the most about. So West Nile virus is transmitted by those mosquitoes. They're called Culex quinquefasciatus mosquitoes. It took me a long time to be able to say that word. But here I have two maps in the right. And so in the blue, you can see the current suitable habitat for these mosquitoes. They're found pretty much on every livable continent in the world, including the United States. And just a side note, they can also be found in the rest of the United States. These mosquitoes are in every state. These are just representing the most suitable habitats. And so something that these researchers did, I took this from a paper that was published a couple of years ago, is they used an AI model using climate change pattern to predict how our landscape is going to change and how that's going to change where these Culex mosquitoes are going to want to live. And so in the red, you can see what it's going to look like. And probably the biggest changes here are in Australia. You know, the entire country is going to be a suitable habitat for these mosquitoes. And Africa, especially Southern Africa, you're also going to find a lot more mosquitoes. And the United States as well. If you see in the blue, the West Coast, there's a little bit of like suitable habitat that is greatly expanded in the AI model. And so all this to say, that's just one example of how climate change is going to increase the incidences of infection from these viruses. There's also some bacteria as well. And as our previous speakers have spoken a lot about, there's also a lot of healthcare disparities in the United States. So minority groups in general are just more likely to acquire disease and also have worse disease outcomes. And I wrote down some of the basic examples that I took from a report NIH came out with a few years ago. So infant mortality and tuberculosis rates in Native American populations significantly higher, 1.5 to 2 times more likely to occur in Native American populations than in white populations. And Native Americans and Mexican Americans also have the lowest rates of health insurance coverage. These diseases are happening a lot more in these minority communities, and they also don't have access to the healthcare or the resources to treat these diseases. An interesting example that came out last week of this is not in the United States, this is in Brazil. But I mean, you can see the title, Neglected Tropical Diseases Risk Correlates with Poverty and Early Ecosystem Destruction. And this is what we're going to see in the United States. You know, populations that aren't as wealthy, don't have that the education and the ability to protect themselves from these diseases are at much higher risk. And it's correlated with poverty as well as early ecosystem destruction.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm your host, Julian Ankeny. That was Lightning Creek Drummers at the 2022 Clearwater River Casino Powwow. And before that, you were listening to a panel on health disparities and mortality in Indian Country. Remember, we'll post audio of the full panel when we post the show. We begin the next panel on centering culture and climate resilience. Christy DeRosa, social work PhD student and research assistant, Trauma-Informed Oregon.
So Michelle and I are representing the Disaster Resilience Learning Network, which is a virtual network led by and for disaster leaders of color here in Oregon. And this network, its origins kind of stem from the in response to the 2020 wildfires that happened here in Oregon that devastated so many communities, but especially our communities of color, and especially those in Southern Oregon. Community-based organizations that were serving those communities of color really recognized not only the disproportionate impacts of these disasters, but really profound gaps in disaster alerts, communication, responses, and recovery. And when we look at the prevention side, the longer term systemic issues that make communities become vulnerable and stay vulnerable when we think about disasters and recovery. So the mission of our network is to advance equitable disaster resilience for people of color by people of color through healing-centered and culturally grounded collaborations and sustainable practices. And today, I kind of already gave away the agenda, but I'm going to be offering some information about a thematic analysis I did with a colleague about what decolonizing and critical scholars have overlaps in terms of approaching disaster resilience. Michelle's going to be offering a wonderful presentation about how NARA Northwest is understanding and implementing disaster resilience in their work. And then we're going to be having a storytelling activity with you guys. So first, I wanted to talk a little bit about the need for really unraveling the term resilience. Resilience is a controversial discussion historically embedded in philosophies that have perpetuated oppressive systems that have harmed our communities of color and especially our low-income communities of color. There are three kind of broad narratives or domains when we think about resilience. The first one being the most well-known one, the bounce back narrative, which is withstanding and recovering rapidly from disruptions. The second one is Build Back Better, which is a little bit newer and was kind of introduced when the term adaptation became really emphasized in resilience. And the idea behind Build Back Better is we're still trying to recover as quickly as possible, but there's some adjustments to what that looks like along the way. And the challenge of these two narratives is they can lead to quick fix, marketized solutions that prioritize restoring economy over helping residents stay in their homes and residents stay within their communities. It also diverts attention away from the emotional impact of disasters. And what is really significant about these two understandings of resilience is that it places onus and burden and that eagle eye on our communities of color and other disproportionately impacted communities. So by emphasizing that communities of color to adapt and to overcome harm, it shifts attention to them rather than actors that contribute to oppressive forces. And in doing so, resilience validates racial capitalism that funds marketized technological solutions over social and political change and cultural restoration. This, in summary, really diverts attention away from why communities suffer from hazards, why marginalized communities suffer disproportionately, and why climate disasters continue to increase in frequency and severity, limiting solutions that are creative and diverse when we think about resilience. A dear friend of mine, Andrew Rousseau, and I got together and we really wanted to hone in on what is disaster resilience as two students trying to navigate this world and seeing how it impacts us and seeing how it impacts our communities. And we also wanted to, in light of decolonizing and critical scholarship that was rising, that was challenging disaster resilience as it's more known on the Eurocentric side, we wanted to know what themes overlapped when we looked at decolonizing scholarship and critical scholarship. The articles we sampled were within the past 5 years and that we did a thematic analysis. So I just wanted to offer just the three main themes that we took away from our thematic analysis of our decolonizing and critical scholars that were really honing in on disaster resilience. The first one is acknowledgement. And I feel like this one is the most obvious one. But what's interesting about acknowledgement of colonialism in dominant resilience narratives is that we sampled articles globally all around the world. And so it was really cool to see how the work that Michelle and I are doing and the work that people are doing in research are recognizing how these themes overlap. So acknowledging colonialism recognizes how on a philosophical level, resilience is embedded in settler colonial practices. And in doing so, devalues and oppresses and erases Indigenous and community of color approaches to healing and approaches to culture and our relationship to land and earth. And I have an illustrative example from Howitt, who is an incredible disaster scholar in Australia, who says really succinctly, in settler colonial societies, histories of racism, misunderstanding, and greed mean that many state procedures and the policies that support them fail to recognize, acknowledge, or respond to realities that affect Indigenous peoples within their jurisdiction. Structural racism, historic injustices, dispossession, and violence, and the normal features of colonial context create very different landscapes for Indigenous peoples. Even well-intentioned actions reinforce and produce vulnerability. And I feel like that last sentence really just resonates with me because we have a lot of good intentioned people in the disaster climate, and recognizing that even those well-intentioned actions can recreate and devalue the oppressive and subjugating forces within resilience work. There you go. The second theme, again, not a huge surprise, is elevating and embracing diverse voices. But what was really significant and interesting about this theme was, one, how do we elevate and embrace, and also recognizing diversity and epistemic pluralism in disaster resilience. It really challenges how, when more dominant understandings of disaster resilience try to bring in community, oftentimes those community members can very quickly be tokenized, or their feedback kind of listened to, but not necessarily applied or taken action to. It also brings to question, who are the representatives of these community members? Because so many are just assumed to be that one truth and representative of all of our communities of color. And this is an illustrative example from Am Young, who really digs deep into decolonizing resilience literature in African tribes. And he says, obviously, the Atkins and the Farfars traditions are diverse, and the methods and practices they follow are of many different kinds, too. The question should not simply be which of these different discourses on Indigenous knowledge is correct. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Indigenous knowledge and culture are diverse, complex, and multiple. If we attempt to reduce these to a unity, as we do so in many of the literatures emanating from Western Academy, with foundational links to colonization, we get tied into these contradictions. And the last theme that we have is reclaiming and remembering resilience. And we have reclaiming to recognize how resilience, decolonizing critical scholarship, has risen as a foil to Western approaches to resilience, but also remembering that resilience and these practices have been going on much, much longer than when Eurocentric dominant understandings kind of took over and colonized and assimilated these landscapes. The illustrative example we have here is from Iba Glova, who did a lot of great community work working with the Lilwat Nation in Canada, and they developed a youth-led community-based curriculum that looked at disaster work and how community wanted to think about a disaster resilience curriculum. And they say resilience is a contested term as described in this article they're referencing. In the context of this article, reclaiming resilience refers to reclaiming skills, spaces, language, and a sense of togetherness that has been and is required to face disaster. And I feel like my big takeaway from that quote is recognizing that in more Eurocentric understandings of disaster resilience, and especially in the current disaster landscape, disaster tends to focus on physical infrastructure and marketized ways of approaching disaster response and preparedness. What we're seeing here is when that historical and temporal context is added to resilience in the way that it's understood, there's more emphasis and a demand for cultural restoration and healing, not just from a clinical side, but from a political side, and recognizing the epistemic injustices our community members have faced. I hope this brief overview of themes helps us dream into diverse and multiple ways of knowing and being as we approach disaster resilience, and rethinking and remembering how our ancestors connected to ourselves, to our bodies, and to land. And I will now turn the time over to Michelle, who's going to offer how resilience is put into practice.
Thank you so much for that, Christy. I'm going to be talking about how NAR Northwest as an urban Indian organization is progressing with this. The quote that you see there is one that I open up with every time I do any kind of presentation regarding disaster resiliency, food sovereignty, and I also do presentations regarding Two-Spirit history and 2S LGBTQ plus advocacy. So just to give a little bit of history, NAR Northwest was founded in 1970 with a need to be able to provide a culturally specific space for, there was a group of men that needed something that was more cultural for them. And as far as having AA meetings, that's how we started. So we've been around for 53 years. We have working on 12 sites throughout the Portland metro area. And our mission is to provide education, physical and mental health services, substance abuse treatment that is culturally appropriate to the American Indian Native and Alaska Native community and to anyone in need. We are Native-owned and Native-led. And on this, I have the Wattis Kiksnawit. That is our NARA Northwest Green Team that was founded, and I actually named it in my language, Nimiputimt, which means stewards of Mother Earth. I'm going to talk about regional first foods that we've, since time immemorial, that we've gathered. Just showing some here, the camas, the huckleberries, the, you know, hunting for our deer, our meat, our buffalo, and this is family that's actually harvesting here. Our salmon, you know, at our, one of our usual spots, Yowinma, which is Rapid River in mid-Idaho. And this is part of every time we gather for anything like this to hunt or gather, this is where our storytelling comes in. This is when we're handing down our traditions. This is when we're talking to family that we are with. And that huckleberry basket has been in my family for a long time. I had used that when I was a very little girl, and I've since passed that on to my grandson for him to use for huckleberry picking going forward. We are working with food sovereignty. We have three sites where we have gardens that we are trying to grow traditional foods, reintroducing them to the area. In the first picture, we see one of our staff with two little kids. That's at our adult residential site, which allows parents to bring their children 5 years and younger, because we don't want to separate those families while they're going through recovery, and being told stories there as they're learning as well to help their parents learn and recover. We have a totem site. That site is really used for the clients there, for our mental health adult clients. And they see that as very therapeutic to be able to just get in there and work with the dirt and the plants, and it helps in their recovery, and they look forward to this every year. So we need to make sure that we can sustain that for our clients. We're combating food insecurity. So with the gardens that we have throughout our sites at NARA Northwest, it helps with the clients. They're able to take some of those home. We provide some to our food pantry. We also get food from Indigenous businesses, local produce. We buy from Indigenous fishermen that are fishing along the Columbia River. We make sure that we want local and sustainable foods for our clients. So we were constantly delivering during the height of the pandemic, getting food boxes out to those in need. So we needed to make sure that we took care of our community that way. They're going to be growing healthy foods because we have our diabetes program that will help our diabetes patients. We'll teach them healthy eating and how to grow healthy food. And we're definitely into composting. And like I said, Wattis Kiksnawit, we're the stewards of Mother Earth. And all of this going through and passing traditions is helping us with decolonization. A lot has helped too with us to reclaim ceremonial space. On your left is a medicine wheel that was actually built a while ago. These are a couple clients that are painting the animals on the wheel, and this is a place for meditation. We had a DPAVE event back in October where we actually had a company come in and help us, and we were able to remove 10,000 square feet of concrete. A lot of people that came out to help. It was great. We had ceremony because it's going to be a new beginning. We're doing this for our youth because we already have the space. We already have a sweat lodge, a fire circle, and the medicine wheel at our adult residential. But now we're getting it to our youth. They're in the process of building the sweat lodge. They're going to be reintroducing salmon berries, sweetgrass, tobacco, native grass, lavender, Oregon grape, other different plants that are of the area. And it's going to help the youth learn, you know, how things were before then, before colonialism, and trying to bring that back. But like I said, as an urban Indian organization, yes, we're definitely going to try to bring that into the urban area. And also they're going to be learning commercial versus traditional, commercial medicines versus traditional medicines, commercial tobacco versus traditional tobacco. So this is really a big stepping stone for us to be able to take that and do that for our community, especially for our youth. We were able to do a lot of outreach. We were able to obtain fans, water cooling kits, bottles of water to be able to go out to the homeless, identify those in need, and to our elders, and be able to make sure that they are comfortable and staying safe. And we're also with community accountability. We're doing our best that we can to reach the unreachable, because we know that there are some out there that are kind of off the radar, but we definitely need to find who they are, make sure they're safe, make sure they have a plan and a way of being safe, and to contact people that they need to, and to let them know that, yes, NARA Northwest is here. We will help you in any way we can.
One family. If we don't stand, who will? On earth.
Wind comes in four corners, four directions, four colors. And death rides on four horsemen. A black snake with some black tanks. How much money do these companies need to make? They could drop their product, but they wanna save a buck. Already extracted billions, when is enough enough? I used to be in the oil fields, getting paid. But I quit, cause oil water I can't drink. Look down and see Kamimi lie die in the mud. I looked up and told myself that enough's enough. Money does not own my soul, living comfortable. It's not in my plans, my hands in the sand. Some things worth more than gold. Some things they can't be sold. Some things can't be replaced. She is your mother, the fresh water is her veins. What is going on? Have we all lost our minds? Every human needs clean water to survive.
You just heard Black Snakes by Prolific the Rapper and A Tribe Called Red. And before that, you were listening to a panel on Centering Culture in Climate Resilience. And again, we'll post the audio of the full panel when we post today's show. That's it for today's show. This is Niipu Mol, Julian Ankeny here, and I've been your host for today's Old Mol Variety Hour show, which has featured audio excerpts from an April conference on Native sovereignty, decolonization, divestment, reparations, and environmental justice, constructing coalitions at the intersections, sponsored by Washington State University, Vancouver, Native Programs, and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice, and co-sponsored by Portland State University's Indigenous Nations Studies programs. Today's show was edited by John Nelson and produced by Desiree Helligers. We're going to play out with the AIM song, Ketiao Yao Oikoloma. Thank you, everyone. This has been Niipu Mol Julian Ankeny for the Old Mol Variety Hour. Yoch Kalo.
Unity song. Hey.